Thank you and welcome everybody. So I'm so excited to welcome Chris Lord here today. He's actually my coach. He's helped me through some really challenging career moves and helped me with my discernment. His background, he's built four different management consulting businesses. His most recent role was with Slalom Consulting as the general manager, where he built their consulting business from under $2 million in 2010 to over $30 million in 2015. He retired a few years ago, and now he generously gives his time to help veterans in transition to civilian life. He works with the veterans at USC in their program there, and he also generously gives his time to help executives in transition as well. So with that, please welcome Chris Lord to the stage.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
How many people have served in uniform for the country? Thank you for your service. I appreciate you. So as Christy said, I retired 4 years ago after building a couple companies. And when Christy asked me, like, hey, could you come talk to this group? It's like the best networking group in Southern California. You can drive up out of Orange County and come to like the real side of the town and see like downtown Pasadena. It's going to be awesome. And I said, what are we going to talk about? She's like, I don't know. She said, but, you know, we have people that come and they want to hear something interesting. I said, I don't know why you asked me then, but I'll show up anyhow. So the idea that we kicked around was this idea that, so how many people have a company with less than 10 people in it? Okay, so in a company less than 10 people, now how many people over 100 people in their company? All right, vast minority in this group. So perfect. So the idea is, one of the things that I've talked about a lot over the years is if you're a small company and really 25 people and below, the idea that really what those people embody makes up your company, whether you like it or not. And so how many people think they're good at recruiting people? How many people are lying to themselves? Yeah, probably. The idea is really hard to recruit these days, right? It's a mashup of all sorts of things going on in the market right now about how to get good talent. But one thing is really clear. If you look at exit interviews, the number one reason that people start to listen to some kind of offer, not why they leave. So if you're asking people why they leave, one, you're asking the wrong question. Ask them why they started listening or started looking. Most often, number one reason, because of their manager. Over 80% of the time. So the idea, if you have a small company and the people are your company, then you better have leadership that keeps people attached to you. Because it's expensive to go get new people. And typically right now, probably a 50% hit rate. If you're familiar right now, for the age group, how many people, most of their workers are between 25 and 35? Okay, good bit. Bless you. So 25 to 35-year-olds right now, average tenure in a job in the United States, 2.5 years. Average. How many people know people in that age group that have been in a job 10 years? There's some out there. So by mathematical just resolution, if the average is 2.5 years and you know anybody out there who's been in a job 10, think about what that means. That means there are a whole bunch of people leaving jobs every 9 months is what it means. So if you think about what keeps people longer term when they're saying they leave or they start to listen because of their management, they have really no loyalty because companies don't have loyalty anymore. The idea of leadership comes to bear. And so one of the things I like to talk about, because everybody talks about leadership. I'm a John Maxwell fan. If you haven't read his stuff, go read his stuff. He's amazing. He's actually a pastor. So he kind of believes if I can lead 1,000-person church on a volunteer basis, I can lead anybody. I kind of agree with him. But the idea of really leadership is just influence, no more, no less. And so the question is, in the economy we're in right now, with the talent pool that we have and the society we live in and this idea that people are moving jobs every 9 to 12 months on average, how do you distinguish yourself as a leader in a company where your people are your asset? And so years ago, I thought about this idea of you know, people talk about vulnerability. They'll talk about transparency. So I'll go all the way back. So my father, born, raised in the South, was a Marine like myself, 6'4", 280 pound man with hands like a bear. When he hit you, you moved across the floor. Like you could not keep your space. So the idea of how the things that he was taught as a leader are no longer in play. If I would have told my father, hey, it's to be a great leader, you have to think about being vulnerable. My father would have been like, I don't even know what that word means. Like, I've never even heard it. What are you talking about? You have to be transparent. No, I don't. My whole job as a leader is to keep everything to myself and tell everybody what we're doing, regardless of what we're doing. Right? In the military, they teach you that the skipper always knows even when he doesn't know. Because that's what leadership used to be. It used to be your defining North Star. It used to be your guiding light. Now this idea of transparency and vulnerability and being truthful and just being out there and just being you and being authentic. How many people does that come naturally to? Okay, couple. All right. It didn't for me, and it doesn't for most of the people I coach. And so I'm going to give you some ideas about how to be a more courageous leader. Because the one thing I will tell you right now, more than ever that I've experienced, is people are afraid. People are afraid. They're afraid of being in transition. They're afraid of looking bad to people. They're afraid of what happens if I get laid off. They're afraid of what happens if my kid gets into a really expensive school. They're afraid of a lot of things. And I would tell you the interesting thing about fear is it's a great motivator. Fear is a great motivator. My father ran a company in Vernon, California. They did manufacturing. They were on the team that created the original 2-liter Coke bottle. Worked for a company called Owens, Illinois. Ginormous company. And basically, he got put into early retirement about 6 months before he would have had a pension. Got no pension from a company after 29 years. Changed him, for sure. So I was afraid to be him. So I got a financial planner at 26 years old and said, I'm going to make enough money and I'm going to put it away and I'm going to retire. I retired at 47. I don't ever have to make another dollar in my life, assuming the market doesn't get too bad. That fear of being him pushed me to do what I did. Fear is a great motivator. So if you're thinking about how are you as a leader, how are you leading the people around you that are your company, to be more courageous, what I would challenge you with is to embrace your fear. To think about your fear and think about how that drives you and what motivates you about it. What does it make you do? How do you make decisions because of what you're fearful for? The really interesting thing is start asking yourself and the people around you, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? Now, 90% of the time I ask that question to somebody I don't know that well, and their first reaction is, I'm not afraid of anything. Just sit for a minute and wait, because it'll come. Next thing you know, they'll say, and if this happens, this happens, this happens, and this happens, I'll find myself here. But I'm not afraid of anything. We're all afraid of something. So start asking yourself the question, what am I afraid of? When I really run something to ground, what am I afraid of? It will start to illuminate all sorts of interesting things about yourself. And if you can share that in small, distinct ways with your team, they will feel more connected to you. And that's what teams really want. Teams want to understand what you as leaders, how you make decisions, how you're going to behave. Because we're all afraid of how somebody's going to behave. But if you've shown me consistently how you react to certain things, I have a better idea, I'll be less fearful. So by walking in and having the courage to ask yourself, what am I afraid of? And asking the people around you what they're afraid of, you can start to be more courageous. And people around you will gravitate to that. It's amazing some of the opportunities you have when you really start to peel your own onion about what you're afraid of. I'm afraid of failing. What does failure really mean? We have all sorts of definitions these days, right? A lot of people are talking about fail fast, fail forward, whatever, whatever, whatever. Failure is one of those words now that's kind of morphed into a non-tragic thing. So are you really worried about failure? Are you really worried about how you appear to your peer group, to your family, to your children? Whatever it is, start thinking about it. How many people have really dug into like what motivates you from a fear perspective? Yeah? Freeing allows you to kind of really open up about what you're doing. Because part of being a good leader, especially uncertain times, is having a North Star. Understanding what you stand for. What are you fighting for? Because everybody around you wants to know what you're fighting for. So in the last company, as Chrissy said, last company I built here in Southern California, my big thing was I had had the opportunity. So I started running a company at 27 years old. I was lucky enough that a couple partners saw me as a young kid, gave me a chance to run a company. I was running a $45 million business at 28. I don't know that I deserved it, but God love them. They saw something I didn't know about. But the idea of when I started this company, this fourth company here in Southern California, I thought, how many people can live their life and say they helped build a company that had a long-lasting legacy to where my children could see that company and say, wow, my father had his fingerprint on that company. How many people get to do that in their life? I was lucky enough to do it four times. So I wanted to build a company that attracted people that would look at that company and go, I have a chance to put my fingerprint on this company too. And I told that story to every single person I interviewed. And the people who got it were like, I've never wanted to work any other place. And the people who didn't get it moved along. And we built a culture around the idea that we could build a company that everybody could put their fingerprint on. And someday, if they had children, their children could see that fingerprint. We believed that was something worth fighting for. The good thing is, when everybody understands that North Star, it is galvanizing, emotionally galvanizing. But you also have to understand that some of that comes with fear. And how do you understand to communicate to somebody, but I'm afraid of something. I'm afraid of this. I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of how I look. I'm afraid of walking into a meeting and having somebody figure out I don't know what I'm talking about. Happens all the time. The other question to be a better, more courageous leader in these times that you need to start asking yourself is, what do I want? Now, here's the rule around asking the question, what I want. You cannot want for somebody else. So try this in your head, right? Because most often what we start with is, I want that person to do something different. I want that person to be different. So if you can't ask a want for somebody else, you have to ask it for yourself. How do you do that? I want people to be here because they want to be here. I can't control anything beyond that. I want to work in an environment where everybody understands what the North Star is. Okay? The idea of wanting, you can only want for yourself. But once again, when you start asking the question about want, want is an emotion. How many people are in transition right now or soon will be in transition? That was somewhat of an oxymoron, right? Because a bunch of you will be in transition and you don't know it yet. All right. So the idea behind, like, how do I really understand what I want? If I'm in transition, I'll tell you three things people talk about. People talk about what they have done, their resume. People talk about what they can do. And people talk about what they want to do. And here's the thrust. Nobody cares about the first two. Nobody cares about what you've done or what you can do. Nobody cares. They care about what you want to do. They may be interested intellectually about what you have done and can do, but they are interested, deeply, emotionally connected to what you want to do. That's something worth fighting for. So the idea of asking people what they're fearful of and asking yourself what you're fearful of, starting to think about what you want and asking people what they want, and you can't want for somebody else, can't want for somebody else to be different, and start talking to people more about what you want. It's inspiring. But it takes courage. Because, once again, it makes you vulnerable. It makes you transparent. You got to kind of open your soul. You got to peel your own onion in front of people. Super uncomfortable. But today, my opinion is, in the world we're all living in, with talent as hard as it is to find, the difference is going to be how good of a courageous leader are you. That's it. So my second company, I was here in Southern California. We just got acquired by a huge Japanese company, Hitachi. We were trying to build this whole new management consulting side. And we were stuck at this crossroads between a Japanese product parent company and the company we had all built prior to this acquisition that was a very fast, very nimble management consulting company. And basically, I was told, here's how your job's going to play out, and you are going to become more of what we want you to be in terms of products, even though we knew it wasn't the right thing. And so it was not what we had built, and it wasn't even what they had bought. But the only thing they knew was how to be a product company. And so everybody started to get uneasy. People were starting to look. People were thinking about leaving. And so I decided one thing. I decided what I wanted more than anything was to give them the value of the asset that they had actually bought, even if that wasn't the way they thought they were going to get it. And I knew how to do that. And so I went in and I went into the CEO of North America and I handed him a resignation letter. And I said, here's what's going to happen. You're going to let me run the company the way we need to run it, and I'm going to produce results. And there's no date on that letter. And the second I'm not doing my job, you ask me, I'll walk in, put a date on it, and we'll call it quits. And then I went and told everybody what I did. Not to be a martyr, but to tell them, because what I wanted more than anything was for us to get it on the way we knew how to do it and make that company money. And I was willing to do it at any day. I was willing to walk away if at any point we weren't fulfilling that. But the fact is, I needed to tell people. I needed them to know what my North Star was. I needed them to know what I was afraid of and what I wanted. Because without that, everybody's guessing. Everybody guesses all the time about what their leader wants, about what decisions they're going to make, how they're going to make those decisions. So I have a 19-year-old and 21-year-old boys, right? And they always, their big thing is, well, if this happened, how would you react? They're trying to probe me, right? And of course, I'm like, well, I'm not going to tell you because I don't want you ever to do that. But the idea of, we're always worried about how people are going to react. Mostly because we don't know. Because it's potluck. We're human beings, and a lot of times you could tell us the same things, give us the same situation 5 different times, and we'll react differently every time. How is that leadership? How can I follow somebody that every time a decision is made, every time a different situation comes up, their reaction is potluck on however they feel that day? It's really hard to follow somebody like that. It'll make you crazy. So the idea of having that want and having that fear, because those things will define boundaries for you. They will define your guardrails. When people know those things about you, they want to help you. They want to be on your team. They want to help you succeed because they see what the end goal is. Start asking yourself those questions. How many people have ever heard of the trust equation by David Meister? Nobody? All right, one, David Meister, M-A-I-S-T-E-R, a book called The Trusted Advisor. You should go read it. If you're a business owner, a business runner, or somebody on a leadership team, go read it. But there is an equation in there, and you can Google this or you can write it down. I'll give it to you right now. The idea of the trust equation is we all want trust. It's the thing we want more than anything. And for years, people talked about it, and people talked about it in this really gooey way. Like, how do you build trust? Trust is this thing. But the idea of David Meister came up with an equation. Now, my undergrad degree is in aeronautical engineering. I'm a rocket scientist. So equations are cool for me. I can work a problem. You give me an equation, I can work a problem. So he says trust equals, and you can write this down or you can look it up online. Trust equals the sum of credibility. Are you credible in that position, in that topic, in that role? Are you credible? Plus reliability. Are you reliable? When you say you're going to do something, does it get done? Do I have to follow up with you 10 times? Plus intimacy. How well do we know each other? And that sum divided by self-orientation. Self-orientation means, do I act in my own best interest before acting in the best interest of others, the team, the company? So people who have a piece of paper, top three, scale of 1 to 5, 5 being best. How credible are you? How reliable are you? How well do we know each other? The bottom one, 1 to 5, 5 being I do everything for myself. Meaning, if you think about it from a math perspective, what you really want is 5s across the top, that make 15, and a 1 on the bottom, and 15 by 1, that makes 15. So top of the scale is 15. You can go home tonight or do it right now before we go into Q&A. Do a quick estimation of somebody you feel like you have trust with and do the math. And if somebody does it real quick, we'll play around. But the idea is real trust starts at about 4.5 and above. If you go home and do this, you will be shocked at how low some of your scores are. And I'll give you the short answer. The short answer is most of us want to build trust by credibility and reliability. We talk a big game. It's how smart we are and how well we get things done. And in the end, guess what? Neither one of them matter. They're table stakes. The only thing that matters is how well we know each other, our intimacy score, and how well I demonstrate to you that I am not self-oriented. That's it. How smart I am, how well I get things done, nonsense. How well we know each other and how often I demonstrate whether I'm self-oriented or not. Well, the only way to get closer to you is start to share about myself and you. And the only way to demonstrate I'm not self-oriented is to show you that I am oriented towards some North Star or a want or a reaction to what I'm afraid of. That's it. All right, anybody do the math real quick? Yes, sir.
Okay, so 5, 5, 0, and 2.
5, 5, 0, and 2. So you don't know this person at all, like intimately, like personally, like me, right? We don't know each other, right? I didn't just put you there. I mean, I should have. If I was smart, I would have put you there and been like, no, ask this question. All right, cool. And a 2 on the bottom, which means I have demonstrated that I'm not that self-oriented. That probably 80% of the time I'll choose the team over myself or the better of the company. Okay? So 10 divided by 2 is 5. That's pretty reasonable. Pretty reasonable. Yeah. And you couldn't get any better on those first two, right? You said 5 and 5. Can't get any better. So the only way to move it is to get to know each other better. So one of the challenges I would tell you, if you want to be a more courageous leader, is go out and spend more personal time with your teams. Get to know them better. Awesome. Cool. Thank you. Yeah, the real crux of this is then think about how that person would rate you. And look at the two numbers. Really interesting stuff. You can Google it, trust equation online. All right, 2 minutes. Everybody's giving me the peace sign. I'm old enough to know what that means. Thank you for that one. All right, so real quick, think about if you want to keep your people longer, be a better leader. To be a better leader today, be more courageous. To be more courageous, think about what you want and what you're afraid of and talk about it. And ask people what they want, can't want for somebody else, and what they're afraid of. You will start to discover things about yourself and the people around you that are deeper than you could ever fathom about leadership from a book. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. We are going to open it up for Q&A right now. Just a reminder on Q&A, it's not a time to share your stories or your comments. Chris will be here after. You can come up and share those with him. Please ask a brief sentence with a question mark at the end. It's not a story and a sentence with a question mark at the end. It's just a sentence with a question mark at the end. Thank you.
Wow, that was a lot of instruction. Yes, sir.
I'm going to start here.
Oh, I'm going to follow you. Okay, my bad.
Great talk, by the way.
Thank you. Woo!
What are some of the consistent values you had in the culture or cultures of your companies?
So the biggest one I would tell you, so I believe in the law of a common enemy. Has anybody heard this before? Yeah. Right? It's like, you know, what is it? My enemy's enemy is my friend kind of thing, right? I use it with siblings. If you've had young kids and there's a toy on the floor and nobody wants it until somebody picks it up and it has value, then life gets bad quick. So I always believed that there had to be something emotionally worth fighting for. Even if that was, if you've ever seen the owner of Under Armour talk, right? He uses a 4-letter explicative and then Nike. That's his mantra, man. God love him. Like to him, that's worth fighting for. My last company, the recruiting team at Slalom, world domination. That's their thing. That's what's fighting for them. They believe that that company is in a position for world domination in the consulting realm. And by the way, I kind of believe them. So to me, it was all about what's worth fighting for. And I always made sure that was front and center for both myself and the people on my team. And sometimes it was one of the first companies I built. It was to be technically excellent every day. That's what we fought for. Everything else was just a byproduct. But we kept that mantra front and center every day. And it led us to do really interesting things for clients, because even if the client at some point was like, I don't have money to finish this, we were like, it's not quite perfect yet. We'll make it perfect. And it was worth fighting for sure. Thank you.
Over here.
Over here.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. As a leader, how do you motivate your employees to stay in your company and be productive? Or do you have any incentives and rewards?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has incentives, but especially in the businesses I was in every survey, every year in all four companies, comp and benefits always the bottom of the list, always. Okay, so assuming comp and benefits are table stakes, the idea of keeping people, in my opinion, was about leadership. And it was about the idea that although I was raised by somebody who never, ever, ever, ever admitted he was wrong, the idea I learned at a pretty young age was admitting I was wrong was okay, because it allowed people to be more connected to me. And so the incentive I had was, I'm just going to be me, and I'm credible and reliable, and I'm going to get to know you really well. So I believed that emotional connection to my teams was the number one most important thing. It's basically the entire thing I built my career on, and all four companies. And today, I still see people every year that I worked with 25 years ago, and we get together for lunches and stuff. Like, to me, deep emotional connection was the thing that kept the consistency. Cared for each other. I'd go so far to say I have loved every single person I've worked with. like deeply. Weddings, births of children, you know, sometimes tragedy, etc. Yeah, deep emotional connection.
Over here.
Right here. God, we're staying on this side of the table.
I'm just going to go over there next.
All right.
What catalyzed your transition between your four companies, and how did you know that it was the right time to leave a company and build another?
Great question. I think about sections of careers as like books and chapters in books.
Questions here.
And so the idea of, are you writing that last page of that chapter, or is there another chapter? And if you ask yourself that repeatedly, you'll know when. Because you'll know you're just kind of out of material. And when you're out of material, finish the book, write two more sentences, shut the book, and get on to the next one. But it's hard. Because there's always that defining moment where maybe there's something left I haven't done. Maybe, and then ultimately is, can, if I know what I want, can I accomplish it here? Tends to be the thing that galvanizes that last piece. Thank you.
Over here, quick.
All right, now you're over here.
Yes.
Wow, that was quick. You were like a ninja. I didn't even see you move. It's awesome. Yes, sir.
Hi, Chris. I was really inspired by your story about that resignation letter. And I was wondering if you could speak to the resources that you had for yourself as an individual first to empower you to make that kind of decision.
Thank you. So I've had a life coach for 27 years, mainly spurred on by my father was not a great father. He was gone. He was a traveling salesman. So he was gone 220, 230 nights a year. Wasn't even in the hospital the day I was born. And so when I had my first son, I was like, holy crap, like, how am I going to do this? I'm an engineer, so I looked for an instruction manual, which they don't come from, right? Which somebody should build, by the way. If you any of you want, build one. Like, because even if it sucked, it'd be better than what's out there. So I took on a life coach mainly for my kids. But what I realized is the things that I struggled with and I was afraid of to be a father were the same things that kept me from being a really, really good leader in business. And so I used that life coach for both. Yeah, because I didn't have a lot of people in the professional area. I had people who gave me a shot, but I wouldn't say they were great coaches or mentors. They kind of said, we believe in you, go do your thing. So I really had to do it. And frankly, to Chrissy's point, a lot of why I do, so everything I do for executives in transition, I do it for free. Because the fact is, I had tons of pitfalls. I'm 32 years old and look at me. Now, thank you. You weren't supposed to laugh at that. I had a lot of bad days, years, months. And so part of it is to try to help executives not fall in to the same holes I did. Because I didn't have a lot of great support, but I got a couple life coaches, and they've been amazing, for sure. Thank you.
Okay, over here first.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. I really, really enjoyed it.
Woo! No, you can just stop there. That's good.
Yeah. I'm curious, other than kind of demonstrating personally to your teams, if you had any tips for how to drive those values of your culture deep into that organization.
So the best way I've watched to do kind of value instantiation in a company is put them on the walls, take them to every meeting. I've made little laminated cards for a couple of my clients that have their values. And while you're sitting there in leadership meetings making decisions, look at them all the time. How many people have read The Millionaire Next Door? Okay, the rest of you need to go do that, like today. Millionaire Next Door talks about have a financial target, and then everything you do every day, every decision, you have to judge whether it gets you closer to the end point or takes you further away, because there's no neutral decision, time's passing. And so to me, if you want to live your values, every decision you make, you better look at that list and say, yep, 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 no, uh-oh, yeah, probably not. You better have it front and center all the time. And I think that's where companies fall down, is they do them and they do an awesome job at them, and then they put them somewhere, and then they make a whole bunch of decisions, and they never connect those two. Have them in front of you and look at the decisions you make and judge them against your values.
Thank you. Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Great speech, by the way.
Woo!
I would like to know, in the area of recruiting, what is the best practice? And I'll tell you why. Because recruiters in general are recruiting on subjects that they have no idea about what the management wants. As an example.
Okay.
You own an aero, aerospace parts factory.
Okay. Okay.
And you have to hire a aerospace engineer.
Yep.
To as a plant manager.
Okay.
And then a 32-year-old girl calls you up to interview you and knows absolutely nothing of what you need.
Okay.
How does that work?
All right.
Because, you know...
Yeah, I'm going to... This is like a four-hour topic that I'm going to do in like 5 seconds. So, one, you used two different words there, which were really interesting. Want and need. Okay? My opinion is recruiting is a combination of want and need. It's the right combination of want and need. And I would tell you right now today, with the resources available, most people believe if I hire you for what I want culturally, I can teach you everything else. So the question is, have you told that recruiter what you want emotionally? Because if you haven't, you're going to be hosed. So the idea of recruiting today, my opinion is, find out what you want for the type of people on your team and go recruit to that. Average job right now, 525 applications for every one job in the United States right now.
Nobody can read them all.
The good news is 520 of those people can do that damn job. The only difference is how they're going to fit. So start focusing more on fit and less on the skills. Thank you.
Up front. Hi, Chris. Really enjoy and learn a lot from your speech.
Yes!
My name is Amy Kwan. I'm from Double Doors, early stage startup. So, given today's tight job market, would you let some mediocre employee go?
Ooh, what's a mediocre employee?
Well, late all the time, do not follow instruction, do not have the skill set that we're really looking for.
All right. Mediocre. Can I ask you? Can I peel your onion a little bit in front
please,
of everybody?
Please.
What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of cannot hire the right person. I'm afraid of if I let her go, that I cannot hire someone fast enough to carry on the job.
Why?
Because the job market is tight.
What happens if that person goes and you can't fill it? What are you really afraid of?
Well, I just said that I'm really afraid of that I cannot find the...
I got it.
Okay, so I know that's the answer.
What are you really afraid of?
I know that's the answer.
You're not really afraid of not hiring somebody. There's something deeper there. What are you really afraid of?
That's it.
How many people believe that? Yeah, right. I'm just being honest with you. That's not what you're really afraid of. You're most often, people are really afraid of I'm going to lose revenue, which, by the way, isn't really what you're afraid of. You're not really afraid of losing revenue. You're afraid of not making money, maybe. You're afraid of... There's much deeper things in there. Explore some of those and then understand when you say a mediocre employee, a lot of people would say employees represent leadership. Thank you. So the idea is, are you being the best leader you can and leading that person to what they're capable of? Now, if they are intellectually incapable of doing the job, get them out. But most of the time, you don't know that yet. You've got to give them the container to flourish in first before deciding whether or not they should go somewhere else. And most often, if you give them the right container, they'll make that decision on their own. Because nobody wants to work at a job you suck at, right? How many people have been in transition or like, oh, I'm going to take this one job, even though it's not awesome, but I'm going to keep looking for my other job while I do this? How many people have tried that? Yeah, really? How'd it work out for you? Yeah, right? Because here's the thing. If I'm going to have one job and look for another job, I have to make a conscious choice every morning to go to my first job and suck at it. And my guess is nobody in this room is the type of person that goes, I'm going to go suck at my job today. Or frankly, you wouldn't be in this room. So think about the container you're giving them first and what you're really afraid of. And tell them that. Here's what I'm really afraid of. I'm afraid that I'm going to put you in front of a client that I've had a relationship with him for 8 years. And I'm afraid you're going to screw it up because you're going to show up late, whatever, whatever, whatever. It's important to me to make him happy because he puts the gas in the gas tank of this company. Can you help me out with that? That's a real conversation. Start having real conversations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right here.
Yes, sir. Hey, Chris, can you comment on a multi-generational environment? We're a team of 24.
Yeah, they're all over the place.
Oh, yeah. We go from 26 to 72 with 24 people.
It's awesome.
Comment implying it's hard to lead that group. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's, once again, a four-hour topic. I'll give you a short one that I realized. For those people who have millennials as children, if you have anybody who's a millennial, and this kind of goes even post-millennial, there is only one thing that they covet more than anything else. Choice. It's all they want. They want choice. So as long as you give them a choice, they're cool. Sometimes that means, I don't want to come to work at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay, you have a choice. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. If there's things that are immovable, that's where they start to react to. First, that's on that side. On the older side, the biggest thing I see post 55 is having people be open about what they know and sharing knowledge because they're afraid, right? What am I afraid of? I'm afraid the young kid's going to take my job. So just say that. Because I guarantee if you tell that younger person, I'm afraid you're going to take my job, they'll laugh at you and be like, dude, I couldn't do this job without you. I don't want to take your job. I just want to learn from you. So just be honest about what you're afraid of. It tends to be a very cohesive topic between generations. Because the good news is, all the generations are afraid of something. Thank you.
Up front.
Up front.
Hey, Chris, Evan. I loved it. I think.
Yeah.
My name's Evan, and I run a digital consulting shop. And a lot of, I think, my focus has been on developing leadership and culture and going there. But I was curious, do you think that the trust equation can be applied to building the business in terms of building client relationships as well?
It came from the book, The Trusted Advisor. Yes, that's actually where it was made. Yeah, because to me, the idea of long-standing relationships with your clients is about trust. And most often, people will go build trust by doing things for somebody, right? And this is how I built four companies and kicked the crap out of everybody else. And I went and got to know the person. And I'd ask them, hey, what do you really want? And they'd be like, I just want you to do this project right. No, what do you really want? What I really want. So one of my biggest clients, woman tells me after a couple months, she says, I'll tell you what I really want. I've been here 27 years. I'm 5 years from retirement. What I want for my last 5 years is to work around really fun people and get some things done that can leave my legacy. So you know how we started every meeting? Are you having fun? And what are we doing this week to leave your legacy? Okay. She retired from a company, big aerospace company down in El Segundo. They gave her a luncheon in the cafeteria. I took her entire team on a yacht overnight and it cost me $100,000 and was worth every penny. She retired 17 years ago and her and I are still friends because I cared about what she wanted. Thank you.
Two more questions.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, that was a really great speech.
I love this. You should just go around and just have everybody say it was great. That's
woo!
Awesome. Woo!
Give you a Ric Flair. I really like where you were talking about, you know, defining your fears and talking about what fears you. And I found that in my own, you know, journeys that defining my fears really helps me crystallize my decisions and understand my goals a little bit better. Could you talk more about, you know, maybe an experience that helped you or how you defined your fears and understanding the worst case scenario or worst case outcomes?
Yeah, I could give you like 1,000 stories and they're all bad. The idea, to your point, the last point you made to me is what's really cool. And that is drive your fears all the way to ground and then see how bad life really is. Because normally what we're afraid of is this kind of thing in the middle ground that we kind of think could happen and we just don't want it to happen. But the fact is in the chain of life, that's only a couple links. Drive it all the way down. What happens if you really lose your job tomorrow? What happens if you lost your prize client tomorrow? What really happens? most often, when you do that and you get it all the way to ground, it's not nearly as bad as you've made it up in your head. Because fear can be super motivating, and it can be super paralyzing. And to me, the paralyzing part of it normally comes when you haven't actually thought all the way through it. Yeah. Thank you.
All the way in the back.
All the way in the back.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for the speech today. Your ears must have been burning last night because this is exactly all the stuff that I've been thinking about. My biggest question for you is, how do you deal with legacy employees, people who have been there for a long time, maybe even longer than you have, and overcoming the attitude of, but this is how we've always done it. You know, nothing's broken right now. Why fix it?
Why do you want to change it?
Because with current trends that we're seeing, if we don't change now, that could threaten the health of the business within 2 to 5 years.
What does health of the business mean?
Overall revenue.
What does that mean to me? If I'm the old man or woman that's been there forever, longer than you, what does it mean to me?
Having a place at the business.
Okay. So why don't you tell that? Like, say, hey, I'm doing this because I want you to have a job here. That's why I want to move. Because I'm afraid that if we don't do this, I won't be able to keep you employed. I'm being honest, right? I mean, those are the people that are the lifeblood of your company normally. Tell them that. Tell them I'm worried about that. I'm fearful of what will happen if we don't change. Tell them that, for sure.
All right. Thank you guys for the great questions today. Thank you for those answers. Very intense.